We continue in our discussion of groups. And the first thing we're going to look at is a very interesting aspect of groups, and that is group dynamics. Building on the recognition of primary and secondary groups, sociologists often focus their studies on either group dynamics, group influence, or a combination of these two areas of inquiry. In terms of group dynamics, sociologists have long explored the ways people act in groups as method for bridging individual and societal level forms of meaning making and activity, drawing heavily on the insights from symbolic interaction and structural functionalist theories. Researchers explore the ways that groups are shaped by and in turn shape societal notions of normal and deviant, as well as societal patterns of inequality. At the same time, researchers explore the ways that groups are formed, negotiated, and adjusted by the actions of individual beings interacting with one another on a newfound and or regular basis. In doing so, studies of group dynamics shed light upon some ways groups reflect, reinforce, and or shift the ongoing reciprocal relationship between self and society. In other words, how we connect in our groups influences ourselves, influences others, make it so that we live out our lives and our identities through these groups. Dramaturgy is what this is called. Most research into group dynamics draw from the dramaturgy approach outlined by Irving Goffman and refined by other symbolic interactions throughout the latter part of the 20th century. Using the metaphor of the theater, Goffman defines social life as information game, wherein people give intentionally transmit information or give off accidentally transmit information, details about themselves through emphasis they place upon social groups to which they belong. Specifically, people spend much of their lives attempting to demonstrate and affirm their membership within groups that are well regarded, while distancing themselves from groups that are stigmatized within society. You know, when I see this, I am so amazed, and I think about Jesus in his life on earth and how he defied this type of dramaturgy. He would eat with the publicans when no one else would eat with them. He would be with the tax collectors and the sinners, as well as be with his disciples training. He would defy so many group dynamics because he saw the kingdom of God bigger than playing the group games. However, we are in this world, and we typically play these group games, though maybe we try not to. We do a lot of dramaturgy. Well, how does that work? Well, part of it is identity work. Drawing upon the dramaturgical insights, sociologists develop the notion of identity work, or the things people do individually or collectively to give meaning to themselves and others. Examining the ways people constructed personnel, collective, group, and social identities, researchers taking an identity work approach have outlined four generic processes whereby people giving meaning to themselves and others within group context. So how does that work? Well, the first part is group members must define an identity into existence. So let's just say a small group or a house church. You know, first of all, people got to agree we're going to plant a church. So there is identity. We're in Christ. We're called to reach the world. We're going to worship together. We're going to encourage one another. So somehow a group may define that. Now, this is, in this case, it's starting a new group. In some cases, it's already an existing group that's been around for a long time, and you just sign up as a member of this group. But somehow, group members must define an identity into existence. Second, group members must establish a set of codes for symbolic symbols that allow people to tell others they are a member of the group. I know in a lot of church planting circles, what they'll do is shortly after the church starts, they'll all get T-shirts, you know, The Way Church. But there's a lot of other ways you can do that too. There could be, certain things that we all do together. We have fellowship meals. And they somehow tell others that, you know, if you have a fellowship meal, you're part of the group. Which very much connected to the third, group members must establish ritual occasions, you know, weekly meetings, opportunities to affirm our membership in the group. There might even be the new members class that meets, and then there's a time when the new members are recognized. That's called identity work. Now, that emotional work is taking that even further. Similar to identity work processes, scholars have noted the tendency for people to alter their emotional expressions, experiences, and understanding in a relationship to group memberships. Specifically, social groups and contexts typically contain feeling rules or cultural understandings or scripts that provide people with clues to how one should feel, how much one should feel, and how one should display the feelings within a given group or situation. When one arrives at a funeral, for example, people will expect one to be sad, appear sad, and do so in a manner that does not distract from the funeral ritual itself. So what we see is these various emotions that in part of a group or that group you will express. This also happens in general in life, emotional work in life. At the individual level, working on one's own emotions, that is college students managing anxiety at a test time. Intrapersonal, working on the emotions of others during interactional interchanges, that is people in wheelchairs managing the discomfort of others in their presence. Or reciprocal, working with others to manage collective emotions, employees managing the negative reactions of bosses or other coworkers during tense working situations. So all of this then contributes to an understanding of self and society. In recent years, dramaturgical scholars have integrated many of the insights on group dynamics to demonstrate the ways groups reflect the reciprocal relationship between selves and societies. They have demonstrated that the primary code that individuals use within groups to signify personal and collective identities rely heavily upon existing societal beliefs, values, and norms. People form groups by doing identity work that blend their personal desires with the symbolic materials provided by social structures. Similarly, people manage and maintain groups and group membership by doing emotional work that aligns their personal feelings with existing structural feeling rules. As a result, groups provide opportunities to examine the ways that selves and structures work hand in hand to varying degree to continuously reproduce individuals and societies predicated upon who we believe ourselves to be, what we believe this says about us, and how we feel about these details. So, to put it in practical terms, Solomon talked about conformity. Research participants would enter a room and sit at a table with several other people who were, let's call them, confederates, meaning that they were actually helping the researcher and helping with the research. The participants and the confederates would be shown one card that had a reference line and another card that had three comparison lines. Subjects were required to select the comparison line that corresponded with the reference length. But then the confederates would all gather in a group. They would be in cahoots or participate with the researchers to disagree with the individual who's making the individual choice. So they were given this line, and you know, the obvious answer to this question is C. But everybody else in the group would start thinking, no, it's not. I think it's A, or I think it's B. And in a large percentage of the case, conformity would occur, and people would be convinced, no, it's not C, it's A or B. This is an example of the power of group dynamics. Now, in group dynamics, another illustration is social loafing. Social loafing refers to the phenomena that can occur when people in a group make less of an effort to achieve a goal than they would working alone. As a result of social loafing, groups can sometimes generate less total output than the combined performance of the members working as individuals. Social loafing results from the lack of motivation when working in groups because individuals do not believe their specific contribution will be evaluated, or maybe nothing or is even needed. As a result, they do not put in as much effort as they otherwise would. Now, I think this is very interesting and has an immediate application with the church. Now, there's phrases in church life that says like 80% of the church, 20% of the church does 80% of the work. And for the most part, people just show up to the worship service. 20% of the church does the work. And you'll find that dynamic and again and again. Now, a courageous, bold, and intelligent leader understands social loafing and somehow can organize the work of the church and organization so that people feel that they are all part of it, that they're important in the process, and that if they don't help out, the church is going to suffer. Because social loafing is just a phenomenon in group dynamics. Another phenomenon is de-individualization. De-individualization refers to the phenomena of relinquishing one's sense of identity, self-awareness, or evaluation apprehension. This can happen as a result of becoming part of a group that fosters obedience to group norms rather than an individual's norms, such as an army or a mob. Once this happens, individuals no longer think about themselves before they act, or may in fact be unaware of their own actions. De-individualization can have quite destructive effects, like increasing odds that someone will commit a crime, engage in violence, or even enforce the law, such as police and riot, over-enforce the law, such as police and riot situations. This is interesting because Charles Manson today, I'm doing this video today, and Charles Manson died. And he had a group, and in this group, he convinced people in his group to kill the Tate individuals in the Tate family. And what was so fascinating about this back in 1969 is that it was as if these other members lost their personal responsibility. And many of these individuals had been in jail for a long time. So now the debate is are they going to let these individuals out of jail or not? And a lot of times there's other examples of this. You know, Jim Jones there was a cult in the late 1970s, and I remember the Jim Jones people drinking Kool-Aid, and there's a mass suicide over these things. So, you know, it is fascinating how group dynamics work, and the de-individualization can, in fact, occur. Another dynamic of group interaction is group polarization. Group polarization refers to the finding that after participating in a group discussion, members tend to advocate more extreme positions or call for riskier courses of action than individuals who did not participate in any discussion. Now, I find this so interesting in my many years of working in churches. Sometimes you'll have a congregation meeting and everybody is totally happy and, you know, the church is going along real fine. And then in the congregation meeting, some discussion occurs and group polarization occurs. You know, I'm in a condo association and it's fascinating how people will come into this group and all of a sudden things that weren't that important become doubly important. So this is a very important thing to consideration. More on group polarization. Group polarization results from two primary mechanisms, social comparison and informational influence. Social comparison refers to the drive of individuals to appear socially desirable. Informational social influence occurs when a person in a situation where he or she is unsure of the correct way to behave. In such situations, that person will often look to others for cues concerning correct behavior. When we conform because we believe that the other's interpretation of an ambiguous situation is more accurate than ours and will help us choose an appropriate course of action, it is informational social influence. So, in other words, what happens is that there gets to be sort of a momentum of this polarization that occurs, like in the homeowners association, where, you know, there's a lot of confusion. And then somebody who looks like they know what they're talking about speaks up, and then some people say, yes, yes, we agree with you. And the next thing is a more radical understanding. You know, another issue is diffusion of responsibility. Diffusion of responsibility, also called the bystander effect, is a social phenomenon which tends to occur in groups of people above a certain critical size when responsibility is not explicitly assigned. A common example would be observing a minor fender bender on a busy freeway. Many people, when they observe something like that, do not stop, do not call the police, assuming someone else will do it. This phenomenon rarely occurs in small groups. In tests involving groups of three or fewer, everyone in the group took action as opposed to groups of over 10, where almost in every test, no one took action. Now, this can happen so often in churches where, because there are larger group dynamics, if someone is off the radar screen, if they're not in a small group or not connected, you know, things can go unnoticed. People can say things like, I belong to this church, but nobody cares about me. No one paid attention that I was hurting the other day. Well, it's because people assume, well, other people are noticing. Or newcomers come to the church and, you know, they're a little bit concerned and whatnot, and no one assumes that they're responsible to make the newcomers feel well. You know, Pam and I have just relocated to Florida for some of the winter months as we're building Christian Leaders Institute, and we are attending new churches. And it is fascinating to me, again, how we will attend and visit and how no one walks up to us and takes responsibility to say hi to us. It's as if it's a diffusion of responsibility. Now, the friendly people are the ones who have the little tag, you know, they are welcomers, and their work is to every week welcome people to church. And their assumption is almost that everyone is new. But it is interesting how little this actually occurs. You know, I'll tell you, if you're part of a church, you're in ministry, I would make a situation that we are all responsible for everyone who comes every week, or get a small group team to make that happen. But this is certainly an issue where the diffusion of responsibility is clearly everywhere around. Here's another social or group dynamic thing called the false consensus effect. The false consensus effect is a tendency for people to project their way of thinking onto other people. In other words, people often assume that everyone else thinks the same way they do. This belief is unsubstantiated by statistical and quantitative data, leading to the perception of a consensus that does not exist. This logical fallacy involves a group or individuals assuming that their own opinions, beliefs, and predilections are more prevalent among the general public than they really are. This bias is commonly present in a group setting where one thinks the collective opinion of their own group matches that of the larger population. Since the members of a group reach a consensus and rarely encounter those who dispute it, they tend to believe that everyone else thinks the same way. This is done to justify one's own belief. I mentioned before that I am part of a country club, and recently there was a big discussion about selling some land to pay down some debt, which is a very interesting discussion. My whole group did not want to sell the land. Hardly anybody I knew wanted to sell the land. And there was sort of a belief that everybody in the country club was going to say no to selling the land. And it would be like, 75% against selling the land. Now, when they actually took the vote, 58% wanted to sell the land. Now, I realize it was not a large majority, but in my mind, I was like, oh, when this vote is done, everybody in my whole group thought that everybody wanted to sell land. But in reality, it wasn't so. We actually had what was called the false consensus effect. You'll have that in churches too, where the pastor and the elders or the deacons or the leaders come with one thought, and everybody they know think that way. But the truth is that others are not thinking that way, and there's another consensus. So they participated in the false consensus effect. Another group dynamic is the illusionary superiority. Illusionary superiority is a cognitive bias in which people overestimate the degree to which they possess desirable qualities relative to others and underestimate their negative qualities relative to others. Such over and underestimation serve to bolster people's self-esteem. People who succumb to the illusionary superiority bias have inflated views of their own characteristic. You will see this in group dynamics as well. They have an illusion of their being right, and they believe that everybody, agrees with them. Those who take the People Smart class at Christian Leaders Institute will deal with a lot of these things as well, where people have the answer man syndrome. They think that they know better than others, or they somehow think that they see the world in a superior way to others. It's very similar to this illusionary superiority. Another dynamic that needs to be talked about is groupthink, and this happens often. Groupthink is a term coined by psychologist Irving Janis to describe a process by which a group can make bad or irrational decisions. In a groupthink situation, each member of the group attempts to conform his or her opinion to what they believe to be the consensus of the group. In a general sense, this seems to be a very rationalistic way to approach the situation. However, this results in a situation in which the group ultimately agrees upon an action which each member might individually consider to be unwise. Now, what happens here is the group dynamic is about really people pleasing each other to the point where they're pleasing each other is more important than the right or the correct or the best decision. This groupthink scenario happens again and again and again in any business, enterprise, in church. We have to be very careful that to notice the dynamics. Would everybody individually think a certain way? You know, one thing I've heard pastors do in business leaders is to, before any decision is made, to have people write down how they individually would handle the decision first before the discussion would occur. And the reason that they do this is because what they want is they want people to also have a connection to their individual perspective so that groupthink just doesn't take over. Groupthink can really take over quickly, especially if you have a church where you have a family or two families that are held in high esteem, and people want to please those families because they know those families have a long history, and you know they're here for a long time and they pay for certain bills. So people have an individual opinion, but then it will slowly get to groupthink, because the group all sort of wants to please the real father in the group. So, you know, again, groupthink is something that happens, and we have to really watch out for that. Another dynamic is the social network dynamic. A social network dynamic is a social structure between actors, either individuals or organizations. It indicates the ways in which they are connected through various social familiarities, ranging from casual acquaintances to close familial bonds. The study of social networks is called both social network analysis and social network theory. Research in a number of academic fields has demonstrated that social networks operate on many levels, from families up to levels of nations, and play a critical role in determining the way problems are solved, organizations are run, and to the degree which individuals succeed in achieving their goals. What they're saying here is that ultimately it is about people, people knowing people. It's who you know in many, many ways. And there's a group dynamic related to the social network you belong to. As a young person, many young people sort of think things are unfair when, you know, there's a group of people or a social network and analysis of a social network. In a lot of ways, we've always had that. In the Old Testament, there were the elders at the city gate. Even in the church, there's the elders, the deacons, the ministers. There is a group of people. And why fight this? The fact is that these are all part of the group dynamics. And what a delicious opportunity we have to interact and love one another and stay away from some of the negatives of group dynamics, but also appreciate the group dynamics for what they are and how we can function and help and be a blessing in every group that we're part of.